This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The town of Bath is celebrating its pirate heritage tomorrow with its There Be Pirates in the Port event, featuring a historical reenactment of the report of Blackbeard's death and two lectures examining the life of Blackbeard and other pirates. Lee Jenkins has more.
For better or worse, piracy is an important part of colonial North Carolina's history. The notorious pirate who operated out of Bath, Blackbeard, is too, and the town he may have called home is proud to honor his legacy with tomorrow's presentations. The legendary Sea Dog has become an increasingly popular figure over the years, serving as one of the definitive examples of a pirate. Bath historical site manager Lee Swain says Blackbeard is also a tremendous contributor to Bath's heritage.
Whether or not he was here his entire life, whether or not he was just here a few months, the importance of Blackbeard to Bath is a strong story for us.
Though he might not have been quite the celebrity he is today, Swain says there's enough evidence to suggest that Blackbeard attracted some kind of affection from the people of Bath, especially when you consider the possibility that Blackbeard was a Bath native.
He did supposedly marry a local girl, so they had to be appreciating him on some level. He would have been bringing in cheap goods, letting them have items they were not normally able to get in such a small little village as Bath. So that could have paved the way for his popularity. If he was one of Bath's own, the son of James Beard, then they certainly would have loved their own pirate.
Despite Blackbeard's historical prominence, historians know surprisingly little about his true identity. Take his date of birth, for instance. According to author and film producer Kevin Duffus, the commonly held belief that he was born sometime around 1680 has almost no factual basis.
I researched the source of that information and discovered that it was first written by a former law professor at Wake Forest University in a 1974 book. He based his estimation of Blackbeard's age at the time of his death on pictures that had been made of Blackbeard about 10 years after he was killed, and these pictures were drawn by artists who had never seen Blackbeard.
Duffus will present his lecture, What's Wrong with Blackbeard, tomorrow at 2 p.m., where he re-examines and debunks much of the lore surrounding the pirate. Of particular salience is his proposition that Blackbeard actually began his career in Bath.
This evidence is really based on the identity and the existence of a black man who became famous as one of Blackbeard's most trusted allies. I have been able to prove his presence in Bath in 1716, 2 years before the Queen Anne's Revenge returned. I don't think that they left Bath thinking that they were going to become pirates, but 2 years later they did, in fact, come back as pirates.
While historians might still be trying to puzzle out Blackbeard's background, his exploits on the high seas are significantly better documented. Those exploits may not match our modern-day preconceptions of a pirate's life, however. Charles Ewan, an anthropology professor at ECU, will expound upon the less-than-glamorous realities of piracy in his lecture, X Marks the Spot, The Archaeology of Piracy. Based on various archaeological discoveries, he's concluded that, ultimately, pirates weren't all that different from the sailors they preyed upon.
I don't think you'd be able to tell just by looking at them whether they were pirates or not. You might be able to tell an ordinary seaman from a pirate in that an ordinary pirate crew member might have nicer clothes or some other stuff that your ordinary seaman wouldn't because they'd stolen it. We've really looked at a lot of the artifacts from pirate ships versus commercial vessels and naval vessels, and it's difficult to really say, ooh, well, that just jumps right out at you.
Aside from a more liberal chain of command and, of course, the rating, pirate ships didn't operate that differently from other, more lawful vessels either.
Pirate ships, the two that we've really looked at, went down with their cannons loaded. And this is something that the Navy certainly didn't do routinely, nor merchant vessels, who usually didn't have a lot of guns. And to sail around with cannons that were loaded at all times meant that you were ready for action. So that might be something. There are some telltale signs, but honestly, there wasn't that big a difference.
The pirate captains were more distinct, at least. According to Ewan, there was no such thing as a typical pirate captain. Each one used different methods and maintained different images, from the gentlemanly Steve Bonnet to the fearsome, fiery Blackbeard himself. For an even more in-depth exploration of the character of Blackbeard and piracy in general, you can attend the lectures presented by Kevin Duffus and Charles Ewan. Duffus's presentation is made possible by a grant from the North Carolina Humanities Council, a statewide nonprofit and affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and will take place at 1 p.m. at the Bath State Historic Site tomorrow. Ewan's presentation will take place on the site at 2. The lectures and reenactment are free and open to the public, with seating on a first-come, first-serve basis. For Public Radio East, I'm Lee Jenkins.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the Pamlico Opry Summer Series. It starts this weekend at the Turnage Theater and is sponsored by the Beaufort County Traditional Music Association and the Beaufort County Arts Council. Kicking off the series is North Carolina-based bluegrass Americana band The Outliers this Saturday at 8 p.m. Today, Mac McKee speaks with band member Julie Brown about her beginnings in music and her career with The Outliers.
Julie, have you always played bluegrass professionally, or have you been influenced by other types of music as well?
Well, my background, personally, I started out playing in the school bands, which was actually my first introduction to music, that and some piano lessons when I was young. And then I didn't play music for a while I was going through college and finishing up all my school. And then I got into playing the upright bass classically, played with some small orchestras, but not a lot and nothing professional. Then I fell in love with the banjo. So I actually was a banjo player before I was a bluegrass bass player.
Oh, so now what made you give up banjo and make that transition to stand-up bass?
I was actually in a band. We couldn't find a bass player, but we could find banjo players. So I switched over and started playing bass.
Now, what's the difference between the traditional stand-up bass, the sound of the traditional stand-up bass, and an electric bass in a bluegrass band?
To me, it's warmer sounding and it's fuller sounding, because the bass gets the on beat, the mandolin gets the off beat, and of course the guitar is working both of those. For me, the upright bass just keeps that sound deeper and warmer than a electric bass.
Are you a songwriter as well as a performer, Julie?
I have only written a few songs myself that I would dare not let anyone else see. But Hank, our guitar player and lead singer, does a big portion of our writing. He writes a lot of the music that you'll hear us play.
Now, how did the Outliers get started, and how did you decide on the name?
Well, Stan and I, Stan is my husband, he's the banjo player. We were looking something to do in music together, because we were both playing still in separate bands and had been for years and years, and we would literally meet on the road to wave at each other. And we had decided that it was time for us to be in a band together where we could be going the same direction in music and on the road traveling. And so we heard through the grapevine that Hank had just come out with a solo project, and he was looking to start up a band, and so it just fell into place.
Now, have you had the opportunity to play in Eastern North Carolina a lot?
We've been around the coastal area some. We actually, the first job we played as a band was in Beaufort. A couple of months ago, we were in New Bern and Fountain.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for talking with us today, and good luck this weekend at your performance at the Turnage Theater.
We're looking forward to it. Can't wait to get there.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. This time of year, as it starts to get hot, people start thinking about watering their plants and wondering how often should they water and how much should they water. So let me give you a couple rules of thumb but keep in mind that every yard is different. Think about how your soil handles water. Think about a good rainstorm. Does the water run right through a sandy soil and the ground is bone dry within just a few minutes of even the heaviest rain? Or does the water sit there and stay wet and boggy on the surface? This gives you an insight into what your soil's like. First of all, if you have that wet, boggy soil, you're going to have a very difficult time establishing any lawn. And there's really not a proper watering regime. If you've got really sandy, dry soil, then you're probably going to want to water twice a week in those weeks where it doesn't rain. Now, that's important. If you have two good rains that each drop an inch of water on the lawn and they're spaced 3 or 4 days apart, well, your lawn has enough water for that week and you don't need to irrigate at all. We are thinking as a rule of thumb that most lawns are going to need 1 inch of water per week, and that inch of water should come all at the same time. Why don't you want to water every single day like so many people do? Going out and holding the hose for 5 or 10 minutes on each spot in the yard, or turning on the irrigation for 15 minutes in each zone. Well, that short time period is only giving you the tiniest bit of water, and it's only wetting the very, very surface of your soil. And that's where your plant roots are going to go. So if the water is always shallow, plant roots are going to be right at the very surface of the soil. Very shallow-rooted plants are not healthy plants. You want water to go deep enough so that it pulls those roots downward into the soil. That good inch of water a week will also work on your shrubs during dry times. Your vegetable garden, well, it's going to have to be watered much more often because those plants are planted very closely together and are growing very quickly and are using a lot more moisture. But don't overwater. They don't like wet feet. As far as your lawn goes, think about resetting that irrigation system so that it doesn't water while it's raining, and certainly so that it doesn't water lightly every single day. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
With the 4th of July holiday behind us, we're well into the summer travel season. That means trips to the beach, and for readers among those travelers, they want a good beach read, and an old-fashioned murder mystery always qualifies. One North Carolina author provides scratches to 2 itches North Carolina readers might have in an ongoing series, something for mystery lovers and something for those partisan to the Old North State. George Olson spoke with the author of the Deborah Knott mystery series and has this, which originally aired in March 2010.
If you've read any of the 15 books in the Deborah Knott Mystery Series, you may have received a surprise along the way. Join the club.
Right now, the book that I'm working on, I'm 15 pages into the book, and I still don't know who's going to get killed. I don't know what the motive's going to be. I just start writing and wait to see what happens.
That's the author of the Deborah Knott series, North Carolina native and resident Margaret Marin. It seems odd, a murder mystery writer who sits down to write and doesn't know when the body will pop up or who it belongs to. But while Marin may not know the who or when, she is firm on the where.
And I wanted to explore the state and look at some of the issues that are facing the state. I've written about race relations. I've written about the furniture market. I've written about the problems pulling at our coastal waters. And I've just tried to take little snapshots of the state and show where we are and where we've been and where we're going. So I start with the setting, and then I let the story flow organically from that setting. Once I'm in the place, then I look around to see who could be a victim that would have enemies amongst the people in that particular setting.
Her latest book is Sand Sharks, set in Wrightsville Beach and Wilmington. This is actually a natural locale for her lead character, who is a North Carolina District Court judge in the fictional Colleton County and arrives at Wrightsville Beach for an annual summer conference of district court judges. The conference is a real event, and the judges have been kind enough to allow Marin to attend.
Over the years, several of them have said, oh, you ought to set a mystery here, you ought to set a mystery here. And a couple of them even had recommendations for who I could kill.
Setting also allows Marin to, as she terms it, get quite emotional about how I love this state. Nevertheless, each book isn't entirely something the local tourism board might quote in its brochures.
But I want to do the warts and all, not just the beautiful scenic part. I want to look at some of the problems. For instance, when I wrote High Country Fall, that took digs at developers who wanted to put housing developments right on the top of the ridges, and touched a little bit on the air pollution that we're getting over from Tennessee.
Likewise, 1994's Shooting at Loons was set on Harker's Island and wove the sometimes contentious relationship between sport and commercial fishermen into its storyline. Still, she uses her mystery series to, quote, write love letters to North Carolina, again, warts and all, while perhaps removing a few warts from literary depictions of Southern families with her portrayal of Deborah Knott's large and messy family.
Too often, people writing about the South, the families are so dysfunctional and they don't like each other. And I just wanted to show an ordinary family that happens to be a large family that like each other and enjoy each other's company. And I just wanted to show a functional family rather than a dysfunctional Southern family, which is too often the case.
In Sand Sharks, Deborah Knott has recently added to her large family with a new husband and his young son. The book opens with an argument, or was it an argument, with her husband Dwight over a small clash she had with their child Cal. That provides Marin the opportunity to work in a regular comic device she uses for her lead character, a three-way dialogue between Deborah Knott and her inner preacher and pragmatist.
Until I felt the tension draining out of my joints and muscles, I didn't realize how much stress I'd been under these last 5 months, adjusting both to marriage and to having Cal with us full time. This would be the longest I'd been away from both of them since January, but there on the hot sand, I finally admitted to myself just how much I'd been looking forward to this week. No personal demands, no stepmother tightropes to walk, only the give and take of professional life, and I wasn't going to feel guilty about enjoying it or let my anger with Dwight ruin it for me. Or so I told myself, because lying on my towel, I was beginning to feel thoroughly miserable. Just as you should, scolded the preacher from the shade of his beach umbrella. You know good and well that Dwight was clueless. If anyone needed to be jumped on, it was Cal. The pragmatist, who only wanted to soak up sun, gave an impatient scowl. He's a child, Dwight's son. She comes down hard on him. Who's Dwight going to side with? The preacher shrugged. So, any other child, one of her nieces or nephews, and she'd either laugh it off or tell him, good try, kid, but it's peanut butter and apples driving up. Y'all can stop for hamburgers on the way home. She wouldn't take it out on Dwight. He was right. What's the big deal? Cal doesn't respect her decisions. He's 9, for Pete's sake. If she's going to drop down to the 9-year-old level every time they butt heads, why should he respect them? Stomping off sure didn't help. I didn't stomp, I said. You stomped, they chorused. Very mature, the preacher sniffed. That only tells Cal that he won the round. Some role model you are. They are the two voices of her conscience, of course. You have the preacher who says, you know, we must always do good. And then you have the pragmatist who says, well, yeah, we should be good, but at the same time, let's not forget that if we can help ourselves, he's the one who will rationalize everything. And I started doing that because Deborah doesn't have a Watson. She's not Sherlock Holmes, and she doesn't have a Watson that she can bounce ideas off of. So she's going to be bouncing them off of her own conscience and her own sense of what's right or wrong.
Marin says with Deborah Knott, you have to suspend your disbelief that a district court judge would find herself so often at the center of murders, but beyond that, she wants her character as realistic as possible. Hence, the event that has her preacher and pragmatist in such an uproar isn't a dense web of lies and deceit stretching back into her character's dark past, but instead a debate over whether her husband and son should travel with a packed lunch rather than stop for fast food. In regards to the judicial system featured in Sand Sharks, Marin's preacher is thankful the judges allow her to attend conferences and answer her questions, but the pragmatist recognizes the system's dark side and uses that to fuel another episode in the reading public's seemingly insatiable appetite for mystery.
We would like to think that our judicial system is pure and that everybody comes to it with clean hands. But judges are politicians. They do have to run an election. They are not always appointed. And I know that there are judges who have things in their background or the way they judge from the seat, from the bench, their actions are not always pure and noble. And in fact, they're downright dirty, some of them. So I took things that I had heard over the years about various judges and gave them all to this one character so that he would be despicable enough that he could make someone want to kill him.
Margaret Marin's latest book is Sand Sharks and is published by Grand Central Publishing. I'm George Olson.
A quick update on the author. Since this piece originally aired in March 2010, Margaret has produced three more Deborah Knott mysteries. The most recent was last year's The Buzzard Table, also published by Grand Central. A new Deborah Knott mystery, Designated Daughters, is released next month. By now, you've heard about our special project to create a new sound for Downey's Journal. Last fall, students in East Carolina University's Department of Theory, Composition, and Musicology went to work imagining, writing, and composing a new theme for DEJ. Five ideas were submitted, and we narrowed them down to three. These student composers went into the recording studio in spring, and by the end of the semester, the fully mixed and mastered tracks were ready. Then we asked you to help us pick the new Downey's Journal theme, and here it is. This theme was composed by Joshua Tomlinson, who during this project was finishing up his master's degree in music, theory, and composition. Now he's enjoying his summer break and preparing to start a doctoral program at the University of Oklahoma. This week, I caught up with our winning composer and told him the good news.
It was exciting to do something not only for your radio station, which I love, but also for Eastern North Carolina. I'm originally from Swansboro, so the idea of creating something for my home area was kind of romantic.
So can you explain the process of coming up with the theme and eventually recording it?
Yeah, long before I learned about this competition, my friend Justin Lindley and I would hang out and play guitar together. We mostly played blues, bluegrass, and folk music, so when you presented the opportunity to write for the Downey's Journal, I thought that what Justin and I were doing might fit your needs and complement your show. The night we recorded, there hadn't been anything pre-written or composed. I wanted us to do what we always did, improvise, so we found something we liked. It didn't take long for inspiration to strike. As I was setting up the recording equipment, Justin was noodling around with a chord progression that I thought would be a great foundation for the theme. And from there, we just started layering ideas. He just so happened to have a harmonica on him, and I had a banjo and a bottleneck slide in the back room, and we just pieced it together.
How many people were involved in the recording process? And kind of explain to me, what was that like?
In total, there were four people involved. There was Travis Garrison, who was our audio technician and producer, William Bewley, an undergraduate music education major who played upright bass, Justin Lindley, a graduate guitar performance major who played banjo and harmonica, and then me. I played guitar and basically just put it all together.
So was there anything interesting or maybe funny that happened while you were in the process of coming up with ideas or maybe recording it in the studio?
Yeah, there's always something that comes up. When we all showed up to record it in the studio, we had unplanned matching uniforms. Justin, William, and I all showed up to the recording studio wearing blue flannel shirts. You can actually see the pictures online. I guess there's something about playing bluegrass that makes a man want to wear flannel.
Now, in the process of recording and coming up with the creative ideas for the themes, was it harder than you imagined?
No, not really. I've been playing music for a while, and I've recorded with groups before. So going into this, I was familiar with some of the musical and technical obstacles we would face. The hardest task is usually finding a convenient time for everyone involved to practice and record.
How much practice was involved?
The three of us, Justin, William, and I, got together two times before we actually met to do the recording.
So, Joshua, you graduated from East Carolina University, getting ready to start your doctoral program after the summer. What do you hope to do with that music theory and composition degree?
I would very much like to continue writing music for my colleagues, festivals, contests, and, you know, other opportunities that present themselves. Primarily, though, I do want to teach music at the collegiate level.
What does it mean to you to be a part of this Downeast Journal theme project and to be selected as our winning composer?
It was a special process for me. It gave me an opportunity to do something musical I've never done. Before this, I've never written anything for a radio theme. Honestly, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. It was great meeting you. It was great working with you. The whole process was a lot of fun and exciting.
I definitely agree. Joshua, it was nice to meet you as well, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.